Hey guys, we're here. We're still alive.
Barely.
Hey.
Brains are fried.
I mean,
yeah, I'm dead.
My brain is never fried.
How many watches do you think you guys have each seen over the last, what, 4 days? A couple hundred?
Maybe not that many.
328.
Yeah, I'll say about 167.
I'll go with 125.
Cool. I'm going to just go with too many. Like,
yeah.
I look at a watch now and it just like, it looks like the idea of a watch. I like can't even identify it anymore.
Do you guys ever need like a watch detox?
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. Actually, that's why I own my Swatch Skin. Is for when I need a watch that's like not a watch.
Right.
Because it's like transparent and paper thin and like kind of like barely there.
Yeah.
It's when I need to like not be near watches.
You know what it is? It's a palate cleanser.
It's a palate cleanser. Yeah. Cleanser. All right. So we got Jack Forster.
Hey, everybody.
We got Cole Pennington.
Hey there.
We got Cara Barrett.
Hi.
And coming soon, Mr. Joe Thompson, who's Woo. Sitting across the room from us right now. He's going to come share some thoughts about the future of Baselworld in a little bit after we get through this year's show.
And this is a man who knows Baselworld.
Yeah. This is Baselworld 40 for Mr. Thompson. It's pretty incredible.
Wow.
And shockingly, he's been here coming since he was 2 years old. He's only 42.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's incredible.
So let's jump into it. Show's over. We've seen, well, for us, show's over. We've seen a lot of things. One thing we haven't talked about on this show yet, because we were waiting for Mr. Forster.
And also their stuff dropped 24 hours after a lot of the other stuff.
Correct.
Sneaky drop.
Classic.
Grand Seiko and Seiko.
Yeah, Grand Seiko.
Big year.
It's a very big year. One of the most interesting things about Grand Seiko, a couple of things. The slim hand wounds with power reserve dropped before the show, but what we got...
Slim hand wound spring drive.
Spring drive.
It's 20th anniversary of spring drive.
Yeah, that's what we got. That's what we got during the show. So the interesting thing about doing a hand wound spring drive watch for Grand Seiko and for Seiko in general is that the first generation of spring drive movements when they were first released, and this is going back 20 years because it's the
when
20th. I'm really bad at back of math. The envelope math.
It's but 2019.
20 years ago, so 1999. So it's been 20 years, and the first generation of spring drives were hand wound. They were manually wound. And, you know, the whole ethos of Grand Seiko was really about, yes, beautiful craftsmanship and a connection to Japanese culture, but, like, the foundation of it is convenience for the consumer, which is why they went automatic. So virtually every automatic, virtually every spring drive movement has been automatic, except for the super high-end stuff like HE2, the Crator Sonnery and Crator Minute Repeaters. Like, if you wanted a hand-wound spring drive movement from Seiko, it would cost you minimum, around $50,000. And, these are still expensive.
And it would be exceptional.
It would be exceptional.
So good.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, for the first time, we have, sort of a general production Grand Seiko wristwatch with a hand-wound spring drive movement. And that's a fun thing to do with spring drive because it reminds you that it's not a quartz watch. You know, it is a mechanical watch with a mechanical going train from the mainspring barrel all the way up to the glide wheel. It gives you an opportunity to kind of directly interact with this technology. And I love the idea of a hand-wound spring drive, and I'm excited about these watches.
Yeah, I do too. And they're really beautiful. They're really, really amazing. The like slim elegance watches and then the anniversary models.
Yeah. The only thing that that I wonder about this is people fell in love with Grand Seiko because they were a tremendous, tremendous bang for the buck. So there was a value proposition from Grand Seiko that you really could not get from a Swiss brand. And that was the perception. But I honestly think that that's also the reality. So at the top end, the hand-wound spring drives are a 70,000-plus platinum-cased watch, which is drop-dead gorgeous.
And I think so that it's so pretty.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, I think if you evaluate it on its merits, it's very hard to argue that it's not, worth it in some sense. But it's not what people are used to from Grand Seiko, and it's not what the Grand Seiko fan base is used to. And to be fair, there's also a sub-$8,000 watch in the same lineup of four watches So it's not as if they're pricing themselves so as to become unavailable to the people who fell in love with them. But I wonder about the optics of that. And I'm actually curious what you guys think.
Well, there's a $70,000 gold Doxa out there.
Oh.
$70,000 Grand Seiko. I think I know which one I'm picking.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also a $40,000 gold G-Shock out there.
Not picking that one. But maybe you are.
TBD.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. And I think, you know, people can complain about the optics and say that, you know, it's not good. Grand Seiko should bring the prices down, maybe whatever. But honestly, I think there's something kind of nice about them committing to this technology and saying, you know, it's the same thing that makes the Ichi so interesting is that, you know, there are a certain category of watch nerds who will say, ah, it has a quartz crystal in it. I'm not paying $50,000 for it. That's ridiculous. This watch should be $50, blah, blah, blah. And those people are dumb. They don't understand what they're talking about. No, I mean, you can choose not to like it. That's fine.
But I agree with you. And I also understand why people might feel that way who haven't yet had a chance.
Totally. I'm just saying, I think, you know, you can choose not to like it. You can choose to think it's not for you. But I think, you know, if you really understand what it is, you can at least acknowledge its merits, maybe.
Yeah.
And I think there's something nice about, you know, they're comfortable and confident and are willing to say, like, you know, it's a big anniversary for us. And we made this beautiful handcrafted platinum wristwatch. And like, yeah, it has spring drive in it. Like, of course, we love spring drive. We believe in spring drive. They're not kind of saying like, oh, this is a lesser thing than our mechanical, automatic, or hand wound.
Yeah, movements. And the two new calibers for these pieces. There's a. I'm trying to remember the reference numbers, but I think it's 9R31 for the less expensive gold and stainless steel models, and 9R9S02 for the high end one. And you know, the higher end one is. It's finished as beautifully as an Aichi 2. And, you know, I mean, that kind of work just doesn't come cheaply. And it feels like a very, 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 you know, beautiful, compelling product. I think it was easier for people to accept that kind of price point for, you know, Aichi, which really seemed like a rarity, than for Grand Seiko, which traditionally people associate with a great value proposition. Yeah. But there's no denying it's a beautiful watch. Or, well, I mean, maybe there is denying it's a beautiful watch, but not in a reasonable world.
I don't want to hear it. Yeah. Nobody can tell me that. Yeah, and you know, the year being all about spring drive, you know, the focus was mostly on these kind of elegant, slim, hand-wound models, but they did introduce some automatics too, including this collection of three, they're calling them the like sports collection, right? They're three new sports watches, a gold chronograph, a steel chronograph,
yep,
and a steel three-hand date.
Right. So those are the so-called Tokyo Lion watches, and those are spring drive also.
Right. They're automatic spring drive.
Automatic spring drive. Yeah. Yep. It honestly took a little getting used to for me because they're thick, very angular, faceted cases. I mean, you can't argue the quality. It's beautifully done, but you know, as a longtime Grand Seiko fan, I associate Grand Seiko with a sort of very discreet, not very discreet, but you know, a certain kind of classicism, sort of classicism through a Japanese filter. And these are, they're not like anything anyone has ever seen from Grand Seiko. But you know, they're fun to be around. And, I'm curious to see how the market and how I will feel about them 6 months from now, because I haven't gotten over the fact that they're shockingly novel for Grand Seiko yet.
I gotta be real. I didn't expect to like them, and I really did.
Did you?
The chronographs are less my thing, but all chronographs are less my thing. Anybody who knows me knows I own like basically exclusively 36 to 39 millimeter three-hand watches. No dates, right. No nothing. But I the three-hand date model, I saw the spec sheet, and I was like, oh, 44.5 millimeters, you got to be kidding me. No. Especially after seeing how beautiful the dials are.
And the dials are incredible.
Dials are amazing. Yeah. They're like this olive green color. They have a hand-carved, stamped-out pattern. They look almost 3D. They're really, really stunning.
Yeah.
But I put it on my wrist, and it's titanium. It has really short, curved lugs. And so the way the bracelet integrates into the case, it almost feels like an integrated bracelet. Like, it sits really low on the wrist. The case is tapered nicely on the sides. You don't see it when it's on your wrist, but...
So, one of the things they were aware of was they wanted to produce a watch that would have a lot of visual presence, but they also wanted it to be wearable and comfortable. So the case, you were saying the case taper, it actually tapers around the bottom of the case so that the amount of metal sitting on your wrist is a lot less than what it looks like.
Yeah, and none of the... From a distance, the watch looks just like razor sharp at every angle. Yeah. But on your wrist... The parts actually touching you are curved and tapered down, so it doesn't wear like it looks, which I think is a really nice kind of like piece of like visual trickery by them.
I feel like they did a great job with those watches. They're not going to be for everybody, but kind of like the Tudor P01 prototype. I think one of the things that Cole loves about that watch is that it's not a watch for everybody. And one of the things I love about these Grand Seikos is they're not a watch for everybody either. But I feel like they'd be fun to wear.
Yeah, I agree. So moving away from Grand Seiko to Seiko, different brand, just a reminder. We had some pretty good stuff too that I know you were into.
Yeah, so a while back in the pod, you asked what's the watch you're looking forward to seeing.
Yeah,
and I said the 6105 reissue.
Which is the Apocalypse Now watch, right?
Which is the Apocalypse Now watch. However, so I will say something kind of interesting, is that I'm saying something
Surprise.
Interesting.
Excuse me, everybody. No. I'm going to be interesting.
Cole is actually incredibly interesting.
What I mean is something interesting about the Apocalypse Now relationship is that obviously Seiko can't put that in front of us, right? That's totally enthusiast-driven thing. But what they did champion was Naomi Umura, a Japanese mountain climber, also wore that watch, but we don't talk about it. So they had his original 6105 and the reissue right next to each other. And that was good because it highlighted how they kind of sized it up, the new one. Also, what I thought was interesting is seeing fresh lume on that watch. It looks almost like, you remember those old Orange Monster, Black Monster, the original one?
I own both of them.
Yeah, me too. The gobs of Lumibrite that they had.
Yeah.
And they were kind of like a greenish color.
Yeah, and when the minute hand and the hour hand were on top of each other, you had this like wonderful like rocket ship.
Yeah, that was so cool. So what I saw in the new 6105, you know, the older ones, they have that kind of like dirty toothpaste lume, that wabi-sabi that is white, but that era of lume kind of gets moldy and weird looking. When you see clean lume on the watch, it changes it completely. That is one sharp watch.
Clean lume on the watch and a Zeratsu polished bezel and, 45 millimeters. I mean, it's
44.
44.
Yeah.
But man, it looks really good.
Yeah, it does. It looks sharp. And yeah, there's the whole thing about price. I don't know. I honestly would potentially do it.
The previous editions they've done of, basically high test versions of vintage watches have been, they sell out fast. They're trading now at
higher than they sold for retail.
Significantly higher than retail. So it's clearly not a bad idea from a commercial standpoint.
Right.
And they're just great looking watches.
Yeah, no, they are. And yeah, like you said, they're never going to go down in value.
Right.
And it's just a very, very cool piece. They did a good job with it. And I like that on the seconds hand, they did the stoplight configuration.
Yeah, I love that too.
Because usually on the older ones, that's gone by now, right? You never see the little red dot anymore. On a really good one, maybe.
But. Yeah, I mean, I love the whole idea of wabi-sabi, but as you know, as our sort of resident vintage dive watch, guy, as you know, it's very hard to find one in good condition. And, to see a watch that you love... relatively speaking, it's a lot of money, $4,000+.
Yeah.
But you're getting, an 8L35 movement, sort of a baby Grand Seiko. You're getting a sapphire crystal, Zeratsu polishing. It's kind of like, it's almost as if what you dreamed that watch would be, but it never actually can be, has suddenly appeared in front of you.
That's totally true. And I remember when I started collecting Seiko, the 6105s were going on eBay with people were buying those as cheap watches to put their own aftermarket dials on and stuff like
that. People were modding them.
It was a popular modding platform,
which makes my hair stand on end.
Yeah, it's kind of, and then you see, all right, this reissue that kind of sets the record straight. This is what, this is the watch.
Yeah.
It welcome, like this is the watch. It's getting some respect now. So I like that, actually.
So that's you and me nerding out
yeah.
on vintage Seiko hard.
Yeah. So Seiko has some other stuff, some good stuff. Presage models with porcelain dials. We saw them last year, 2 years ago, with enamel dials. There's a whole bunch of new prospects. Divers. We'll be covering all of them on the site. Some of them we've already covered. But you can go check those out. We'll link up what we have already covered. We saw some other stuff today too, right, Kara?
Yes, I saw some things.
What were you into?
So I wasn't on the podcast yesterday, so I'm going to kind of combine the past couple of days on what I saw. I saw Hublot with James, and I thought that was actually really fun.
Also going to go hype on Hublot?
I was a really fun meeting, I'm not going to lie. Right. I was into their Sapphire 38 millimeter watch, or maybe it was like...
Wait, I missed this.
It was last year, and that came out, and I covered it. And then they came out with more Sapphire things, and I just think the Sapphire thing is kind of like...
Like full Sapphire cases.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as over the top and totally unnecessary and ridiculous as they are, like, it's a cool thing, and so I really enjoy that. So there was Hublot, and so they also had some rainbows, which, you know, I'll get into that later. But
of course you will.
Well, I'm just saying, rainbows are trending.
It's on brand.
Everyone's tired of me talking about it, but I'm telling you, they're everywhere, including on Haribo gummies. Anyways.
Hey, Kara.
Yeah.
So you and I took a G-Shock meeting today.
Yes, we took a G-Shock, a Casio together. Meeting.
Casio meeting.
Yep. And they, too, have gotten on to the rainbow trend, not in a literal sense, but they
not in the diamond sense.
Yes, not in the diamond sapphire sense.
It's not covered in gemstones. Is it even a rainbow?
But this is an abstract version of a rainbow.
Okay.
And it was a metal G-Shock that had been iodized? Ionized?
Iodized
table.
Involves iodine, which is not the same.
Covered it in salt.
Guys, I'm not a scientist.
Here's
anyways.
Jack.
So
here's Jack jumping in for technical clarification.
Thank you, it's a, Jack. It's, this is my call out box right here.
So it's an ion plating process.
Yes.
But it produces this really beautiful and for a G-Shock very unexpected, iridescent rainbow effect.
Yes, and each one is unique because it never ends up being the same. It's $1,000 a pop.
That's a lot cheaper than a Rainbow Daytona.
Which is a fraction, a mere fraction, the cost of a Rainbow Daytona. I would say it's like 1/90th, if we're going to be accurate.
1/94th.
1/94th?
Something like that.
0.35. Yeah. Anyways, but so yeah, that was a really fun meeting, especially to kind of see what they're up to.
So Kara, there was also an art piece they showed us.
Made with swords.
Made by with decoration from a family of Japanese sword makers.
Yeah, that was insane.
Who have been making Japanese swords, the you know, katanas and other Japanese swords for 800 years.
Yes, and he made the prototypes of the links all hand engraved. They're hand etched, and then they were recreated to create a bracelet. It was actually really crazy.
I'm surprised that made it through the security at Baselworld.
I'm trying to think if my family
Jack
has been doing.
Jack didn't wonder where the sword was.
I'm trying to think if my family's been doing anything for 800 years.
I have no idea where my family was 800 years ago.
That's my family's craft.
I think
you've
they're
been
like
complaining
like
for 800
years. In Ireland somewhere farming potatoes. But anyways, it was, you know.
It's kind of
not making swords. That's for damn sure.
I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing to see, and I think it was John Buse, who's unfortunately not with us,
at the fair.
At the fair.
John Buse is fine.
Shout out to John Buse, yeah. Who is totally fine.
John is enjoying his weekend currently.
True story.
Because it's Saturday.
But he texted me a couple of days ago and said, did you know that three of the three oldest restaurants in the world are all in Japan?
Huh.
I'm not sure if that's
a classic John Buse.
Yes,
text.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's a good John fact. I like that.
So I'm not sure if I'm remembering his text correctly, actually completely factually correctly. But Japan is one of those places where the same family there are a lot of families that have been doing the same thing for 300, 400, yeah. 500, 800 years. Apparently, these guys have been making swords for 800 years.
Yeah, it was pretty wild to see. They had pictures of them too, dating back 800 years of the family members.
Cool.
Which sourcing those, I imagine, was pretty difficult, but it was like, very cool.
Cool,
and they're anyways. Like fine. They're like fine. We'll decorate a G-Shock. Yeah.
Another nice. Cool thing I saw was De Bethune with James today.
Yeah,
he's not here to talk about it because they came.
I'm
with the
so
dive
upset
watch.
I didn't get to see this watch. I was supposed to go see it with you guys.
I don't know if I'm like slow on the uptake, like why it took me so long to really like get over there and see that stuff. But it was cool. Like, it was a 45 millimeter watch, and it fit my wrist like a glove.
Dude, articulated lugs.
I know. It was awesome. I loved it. It was so
this
cool.
This one has
$80,000, though.
It has the piezoelectric lights in it, right?
Yeah, it lights up. You press a button, and it lights up. Takes the mainspring power, and it just poof, lights up.
Oh, wait. So cool. Who did a piezoelectric astronaut?
Van Cleef.
Van Cleef and Arpels.
Van Cleef, yeah.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah. All right, so, Cole, before we move on, yes, and we sir. Bring... Mr. Thompson on to tell us a little bit about this year and the fate of Baselworld. There's one more watch. We've been talking about it for days, literally for days, the entire show.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You finally saw it in the metal.
Oh, what is it?
Tell us about the damn Zodiac GMT.
Oh. All right. Well, I guess
you're going to make us beg, aren't you?
Yeah. So actually some commenters, commented on the introducing post saying, you know, did you get to take pictures? Did you get to pictures? Yes, it's coming. That will
be coming
soon,
right?
That'll be up tomorrow.
Perfect.
So you got something to look forward to there.
Whew, that's a relief.
You're welcome, everybody.
So
people went bananas over that watch.
They did. They liked it.
One of our digital producers is knocking.
Everything is fine.
It's been a long day, man. I understand.
It's all good, guys.
It's fine.
So something interesting. I mean, in the meeting they mentioned, we kind of went through the history of Zodiac, which I'll put this all in the post and everything. Some just interesting tidbit before I get into the watch itself. They said that they pointed to the Zodiac Killer as contributing to the downfall of the brand.
Yeah.
I actually believe that.
Yeah. When your brand is closely aligned with the most notorious serial killer in America. Yeah.
Well, come
yeah.
on.
Well, I mean, it wasn't.
I don't
he
know,
was at the time he was
well,
killing.
There were a
I was going to say working. That's a weird thing to say.
like at
yeah.
work.
But like he signed the notes with the same logo as the brand.
Yeah.
Maybe that's messed up.
So that's so...
The 70s were
that was my,
very hot yeah. for serial killers.
Maybe we don't need to go full ham serial killer.
Yeah. So, okay, serial killers aside.
Yeah, that's just an interesting tidbit. So,
great segue.
The watch is awesome. It really is. In the metal, I mean, so here's the thing. Another thing about the watch is it's the Seawolf. It literally is the Seawolf. So if you're familiar with that case sizing, and if you like the way it fits on your wrist, this is literally the same. They just kind of changed the lug design a little bit. But yeah, so they took that case and gave it the GMT treatment. And that's a proven good design, the modern Seawolf, modern reedition. The Gulf livery, I don't even know what you want to say, what you want to call it, the orange and blue one.
It's kind of one of their signatures.
Well, yeah, it is. It actually came from the Seawolf also. You know, they had the watermelon Seawolf last
yeah.
year. Yeah, that one, you know, knocked out of the park. Everyone loved it. Before that, even, you had the Gulf livery. So obviously, if you liked it then, you'll like it now. It's nice. It's cool. It's loud. It's a great watch for summer. And as I feel like it's warmer here in Basel than it is probably back home, but it feels like summer today.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, walking out of the meeting, I'm thinking, you know, it's kind of hot out. That watch. That's the watch I want on my wrist right now. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'll put everything in the article. I don't want to, you know. I can talk for hours about this, I'm sure.
Yeah, please don't.
I won't. But
let's spread it out over several podcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Sweet.
I liked it.
Awesome. Well, with that, let's bring Mr. Thompson on. Let's talk about the fate of Baselworld.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right.
So before we introduce Mr. Joe Thompson, I want to say that his sound check was the opening lines of the Gettysburg Address.
It's pretty amazing.
Joe.
Yes. Only Joe Thompson.
Great speech, yeah. Gotta say.
The man
could give a good speech.
It's a good speech.
Well,
yeah.
He couldn't give it, but he could write one.
Certainly could.
Mr. Lincoln. Yes.
Sir. All right, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, well, okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Joe, and I'm the business reporter for Hodinkee. And so the big business story at the show, pretty much the only business story at the show, was the crisis of Baselworld. This is the second year in a row that the big business story was about the show itself. And the crisis, as I guess everybody knows, is that is whether or not there is really a role for a show like Baselworld in the digital age. 12 years ago, there were 2,109 exhibitors at this show. 3 years ago, there were 1,500 exhibitors at this show. At this show, there were 500 exhibitors. As Mr. Michelle Loris Malikoff, the new show director, said, frankly, we've hit bottom, and this does have to be the bottom. So the question is, where do they go from here? Well, the answer to that was what it was in a new thing for this show, a secret room called the Blue Room. I personally have not been in the Blue Room. I have my appointment there tomorrow. But even if I were to have been in the Blue Room, I couldn't tell you, because I will have to sign, when I go tomorrow, an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, not to reveal anything about what I learn in there. I'm not sure why all this is so top secret, but it is. And what's happening is that the new management has come up with a totally new concept for what Baselworld will be. Baselworld 2019 is a transitional show. And the less said about it, probably the better. The focus of the new team has been on 2020. And what they've said is that it's going to be a complete redo and rethink of the show. It's going to be a live event platform that they want to be year-round, so it will be digital, with a very, very strong consumer-facing component. Sounds great. What that means in detail, we don't know. It's in the Blue Room. So the executives, the decision-makers, and the fate of the show resides on the exhibitors. That's the economic model. You know, you can make money at 2,000 exhibitors. You lose a lot of money at 500. So people have to make a decision. So they're having the exhibitors come. I saw, for example, Mr. Schäuble of Chopard, you know, going into the Blue Room to get the presentation. And in there are the details that everybody's craving to know about what consumer-facing and digital mean for Baselworld.
So, Joe, not to jump in, but just for clarification, there's a presentation space called the Blue Room.
That's right.
Where the new show management for MCH Group are presenting what their concept will be for 2020?
Digitally. There's a video, I'm told. And everybody's going to see this.
The Blue Room sounds like something out of a David Lynch movie. Like
The
Blue Room,
no.
You sign your life away, you go in, you get hypnotized, you come out, you sign up for Baselworld.
Do you come out?
You come out.
A clone comes out? Who knows?
There's a new, there's an element, obviously, of intrigue about this. It's all going to be disclosed, my understanding is, at the end of the show on Tuesday. And then we'll kind of go from there. So the critical question is, will the new concept that the new management has come up with persuade enough people to come back to Baselworld in 2020? Now, nothing is certain. But certain things we can say, we can make some guesses. We can guess that the anchor brands here, which are Rolex and Patek Philippe, that have historically been very, very supportive of the show, there's a strong indication that they would come back, although nothing is certain. The LVMH group, another really, really important, with the four brands, you know, Bulgari, Hublot, Tag Heuer, Zenith, they will decide individually. There's not a group decision there. And, you know, nothing is certain. Other question, will Breitling pull out, which is what the rumor is? Nothing is certain, but that's sort of expected. It's expected that there will be a new economic model. There'll be a new pricing structure for the show. The new management has said that certainly not everybody should be paying the same rate. There are also already rumors around the show of, the prices will drop by 15%. I mean, I don't know if any of this is true.
I've spoken to a few of the independent watchmakers, and apparently they're trying to create a more sort of friendly environment for the small independent brands. Very, very low pricing, easy entry, and you know the independent brands are sexy. I mean, there are a lot of people who come here as excited to see what's being done by somebody like Karsten Frausdorf, as what's done by Omega,
as well. Well, you make the right point. Yeah, you cannot see what's done by Omega here.
That's right,
because the Swatch Group famously pulled out of the show last July, and that's the question. That the elephant not in the room was the Swatch Group with its 18 brands. Can they be lured back? Nick Hayek, the CEO of the Swatch Group, said before the show that they can't. But nothing is certain. He has not seen the presentation about 2020. There, most people think he certainly will not, or the Swatch Group will certainly not be back. But there's some controversy. The retail, for example, the American retailers are very unhappy that in 2 months, the past 2 months, they've had to go to source material to see watches in Geneva, and then in Basel, and then to go to see six prestige Swatch Group brands that are showing up at the Hayek Engineering Building in Zurich. And they're saying to the Swiss, you've got to get yourselves together. We don't want to have to go to three. And that's happening. Next year, the shows are back to back. So just to wrap this part of it up, there is going to be the next, people tell me, all of them are saying, the next few weeks are absolutely determinative. SIHH is also going to be negotiating. They have to save their show in a certain, because they've lost Audemars Piguet and Richard Mille for next year. So it's for the blue smoke has moved from the shows a little bit towards the brands. For the first time in a long, long time, the brands have some sort of negotiating posture with the shows, and we will see what happens. So now it's a Rubik's Cube. Because of the timing of the shows in May next year, it's late April and early May, and who's going to go where? Are other people going to pull out the way Movado Group did and have its own little show, or the way Breitling may do and have road shows, et cetera, et cetera? And so we'll know much more in a month, but right now we don't know. I'll end by just saying about how important all of this is. The Basel World Show is owned by a show company, 40-plus events, live events, shows, and shows. On the first day of the show, they quietly released their financial results for 2018, and they lost $190
million. $190 million?
Million Swiss francs, which is equivalent. It's a dollars. So Swiss francs. In fiscal, now that's not all Baselworld. There are other things, but a large percentage of it is Baselworld.
Did they break it out?
A little bit. They did break it out. A little bit is a show that they've sold losses on that. There are a couple other losses, but the devaluation of the value of the entire complex that has occurred, you know, it has shrunk to 500 from 2,000 in the course of a decade. So Baselworld is a key. It was the cash cow. It was the cash cow. Then, you know, Art Basel, of course, became a big, big revenue producer. So 2 years ago, In fiscal 2017, they lost more than $100 million. This is starting to add up. In fiscal 2019, they are predicting losses. So it is absolutely crucial that Baselworld, and they don't have forever, that the presentation go well if they're going to survive, and that they get the support of as many people as possible. And we'll just see what happens.
We were both at Davos with the Movado Group together, and they spent about 25% of what they would have spent to be in Baselworld.
That's right, Jack.
And they did not have to share attention with anyone. Now, this is a group, but do you think that this is the future? Because I don't honestly see how... I don't see how Baselworld could possibly roll back their business model enough to attract the Movado Group to come back, and the Movado Group seems completely uninterested in coming back.
Correct. But then you have the other side of this, which is where people say, well, without Baselworld, so many of the brands are not able to afford to have their own... I mean, you know...
The Movado Group
is going to be coming in soon with their results, estimated about $660 million. Not everybody has those resources. They have 11 brands there. So that this gathering of the mid-price brand, the mid-price people here are really hoping that the anchors, which are Rolex and Patek, come back because they still do business here. They still write business here. And so if it completely fragments, we don't know where it goes. And even the Movado group, next year, Baselworld and SIHH are in the last week of April and the first week of May, and conflict with Ramadan. There's still all kinds of conflicts here.
Yeah, it's kind of, that's.
But will the Movado group want to wait till May to have their Davos experience? Then, if not, then the cost probably will go up. And that's one question being debated. Okay, if this dies, what happens with this complete fragmentation?
So, one of the things that fragmentation also produces is a problem on the media side. I mean, it's a problem on the buying side. But if you're a watch retailer, worst case, they send you some really beautiful high-res photos, you make your choices, and you buy things. You know, like, I think the retailers will figure it out. On the media side, the reason that somebody like Movado Group does something before Baselworld is because they know people are already here in Switzerland. If this gets fragmented and we end up in a world where there's an SIHH, there's a Baselworld, there's something Swatch Group is doing, there's something Movado Group is doing, Rolex does their own thing, Patek does their own thing, Breitling does their own thing, AP does their own thing, Richard Mille does something. You know, we might send somebody over to Switzerland or find somebody here full-time just to do the shows for us. But you know who's not coming over here? The fashion editor of the New York Times. You know who else isn't coming over here? The folks from GQ and Esquire and Town and Country and the LA Times and, like, the kind of mainstream press are not going to send somebody over to Switzerland for 2 or 3 days every time one watch brand wants to show off a handful of products.
For every time a brand or group got mad at Baselworld and decided to have their own show.
Right. Yeah, it's just not going to happen. So what it's going to do is it's going to be bad for the whole industry because people are just not going to cover these things. It's going to reduce the visibility of the entire industry as this gets more fragmented, right?
I mean, well, yes, but regional shows may spring up. Already there's talk about Watches and Wonders in Miami next February, which is actually after the January SIHH. So that may be the launch show for the Americas as a pre-Baselworld. But May is very late for a late April. You know, you've got to really have your supply line constricted if you're not taking orders to May. Now people will take orders prior to May. There's no doubt about that. But that's what this is a wrangle. All of this is a huge wrangle right now. Yeah.
That's an interesting thing. Can you just explain that real quick for people who may not understand how this works? So, you know, my understanding right now is that, you know, let's say we're in March. You come here, you're a retailer, you place your orders, and then the product starts delivering later in the year. Q4 is the biggest time for the watch business. If you're not placing orders till May, do you think these brands are going to be able to get product into stores by holiday?
Well, we know what the normal supply chain is, so that if you place your order now, you know, they'll then start producing. They'll know the quantities to produce. They'll know the regions it needs to get to, and you hope that it gets there by the fourth quarter. That's what you're shooting for.
Yeah, you
so
hope.
You've got X months to get it there. And if you're not placing orders till the second quarter, darn near the summer, you're probably not going to get that's a 2000. Where are we now? Okay, that's a 2021 product. So no, the bigger firms will already be placing orders locally. Most of the firms now, the larger firms, do not sell here anymore. It used to be that you sold 70%. Of your volume, your orders were placed here. It's for a lot of them. For most of the, it's switched. Now you sell 30% here, but you've got subsidiaries, and so the orders are being placed, you know, locally, and that's why this show has to become a B2C show. We don't know what does it mean. We know that. We'll find out. It's in the blue room. I'll find out tomorrow.
That's not tell us.
Room.
But yes. that's really the only way for it to survive. But you know, just listening to what you and Stephen have been talking about, and you know, I kind of want to throw this out to Cara and Cole as well. You know, we are as journalists, we're very, very attuned to, you know, what the information cycle is and the product development cycle is. you know, from the shows versus what actually, you know, gets to consumers. But like, how much does any of this actually matter to end consumers? You know, to somebody who is, you know, looking to buy, you know, a Swiss made product between, you know, three and I'm going to throw a number out there between like a $300 and $8,000. Is any of this going to make a difference to consumers, or is this all just internal wrangling that has a really interesting anthropological aspect for those of us who watch the industry, but it's not going to make all that much difference to end consumers, or is it?
I mean, I think no, but also yes, because I think if you can't get the information, well, if you can't get the information to people in a timely fashion, they won't know what's going on. And if you can't get the product in store, then they also won't know what's going on. Because not everybody reads Hodinkee, not everybody reads magazines to buy watches. They just go into the store to see what they have and they try them on. So those people won't, well, I don't really know what I'm saying anymore, but those people won't know.
No, I think you're right.
Any, they won't feel any difference. Yeah, but like right. The enthusiasts and the collectors and the people who really follow the market and really follow the pieces and really want to buy watches regularly will be affected by it. But those who are just buying a one-off won't know the difference.
I think companies will adjust. I mean,
yeah,
I just
of course,
think they will need to adjust the supply chain, and maybe they will do regional launches and things like that. There is, and this is the debate. There's an enormous debate. And the debates, I can't tell. Everybody says, you know, we're having a great debate. I mean, I'm saying to people, are you coming back next year? That's a debate. That's why the next month, I would say, is so significant. But to your question, yeah, I mean, the industry is going to go on. This is a problem with the show. Not the industry.
Exactly.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation. We are going to have you back on, Joe. Oh, your eyes just got so wide when I said that. We're dragging you back. We're going to do, you know, in the next couple weeks or the next, you know, 2-3 months, we're going to digest this. Maybe we'll wait till after Swatch does their media show in May, which Joe, you and I will both be attending. Maybe in the wake of that, we'll get everybody back together and do a whole show on kind of what the future of the industry looks like in this way. You know, what do the shows look like? How does it affect consumers? How does it affect media? We'll hash it all out. We'll see if we have some answers.
Can't wait.
I mean, he's going to see the future
tomorrow,
and not be allowed to tell any of us about it.
And I can talk about it Wednesday.
So we're going to wrap things up here. We all got to write a couple final stories, go pack our bags and get ready to head back to New York. But before we do that, let's close with a little question I got for everybody. Two questions. What for you was the highlight of this year's show? And what is the thing you are most hoping to see in next year's show? It can be a product. It can be something that happened. It can be a general thing. But let's start with Kara, right on my left. What for you was the highlight, and what do you want to see next year?
For me, the highlight, personally, was discovering new brands. Not new brands, but brands that existed that I had not spent much time seeing or looking at, because if you're on the ground at Basel in the past years, we lost like 20 brands to see, which obviously take up 20 hours of time,
right?
If you really think about it. So you were able to kind of explore more and spread the team out a little bit more to see new things. So I saw Casio with Jack. I saw Debathune with James. I was able to learn more about Zodiac, and I was able to see, you know, Oris and all these kind of brands that I don't always get to visit during the fair because we kind of just divide things up. So I felt really grateful to be able to kind of explore that market. And I think that the fair, now that it's smaller, and I was talking about this earlier offline, is that now that, you know, the Swatch Group is out, which everybody knows the Swatch Group brands, you know, Longines, you know, Omega. It allowed other brands to shine, and it allowed LVMH to shine. It allowed the kind of more accessible brands to shine. It allowed the independents to shine. And it's, you know, it's the same at SIHH. You don't get to, it's a very specific fair. And then this one kind of allowed us to see more stuff. And I think that that was exciting. And I think it was exciting for the readers. I think it was exciting for the editors. You know, having Cole on board was great. He has a totally new perspective, and that was exciting
for
me too.
You felt the absence of some tentpole brands actually allowed us and consumers to focus on some things that we might not otherwise have focused on.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the thing is we're always going to pay attention to the Swatch brands. They, you know, it's a huge company. It owns many
brands.
And they're
important brands.
And they're really important brands. It's exactly. Like, we will always cover Omega, no matter if they're at Basel or whether they're not at Basel. And that's true, because, like, people love Omega, and we do too. And so I think that it was nice at the fair to be able to kind of spend more time with other people, and really be able to focus on those watches. And there were some great watches this year. And I could go on. Should I go on?
Tell me what you want to see next year.
Oh, okay, next year. More rainbows?
More M-O-A-R
Jacob, which rainbows are trending? Whatever. We could do a separate podcast on that. really could talk for an hour.
We're super not.
But we're not going to. Damn it. what do I want to see next year? This year I saw a lot more ladies' watches, and I want to keep seeing that, and not necessarily branded as ladies' watches, but watches that women can wear. And there really were a lot. Since I started at Hodinkee, the watch market for women has totally changed, and I think that's really exciting.
What Basel is this for you?
Fourth.
Ooh, getting big time.
I know. I'm like a regular now.
One-tenth of Joe Thompson.
I'm no Joe Thompson, though.
You're a fixture.
Eh, that's a stretch, but maybe next year. Maybe my fifth year.
All right.
Do I get a present for my fifth year?
No.
Okay.
You get to come to Basel.
You might get a cake.
Cole, Basel 1. Sir. What was your favorite thing first year of Basel?
All right, I'm going to go real general and just say actually getting to go to Basel.
Yeah.
That was my favorite thing, you know? It's something, yeah.
Because people don't realize, like, you're obviously a watch guy. Like, you probably, I would assume, knew about this and, like, wanted to come.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, definitely. And, yeah, I've been reading, you know, Hodinkee's coverage. I always thought it was kind of one of those things that I'm going to do before I die. I'm going to go to Basel before I die. And now, you know, a few years later, I'm here. So that was awesome. You literally eat, sleep, and breathe watches. So that, you know, you think that anything in excess is too much, but I don't know. I kind of liked it.
Not here.
I don't know if I could. Yeah, like I'm serious when I say eat, sleep, and breathe. You literally eat at dinners. At dinners, you're talking about watches. Sleep, you don't really actually get much of. So I can't say that. But breathe, yeah, you're breathing the air in Hall 1 all the time. And, yeah, it was kind of cool because if I do this outside of this context and talk about watches or do watch stuff, it's like people start to say, all right, cool it with the watch stuff. Here, I feel like I'm even on the kind of the lower end of the spectrum in terms of talking about watches all the time.
You found your people.
That's right, found my tribe.
Perfect. What do you want to see next year? Because you're coming next year. You don't have a choice. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, bro.
Sorry. I'm looking forward to it. So I guess I'll go back to this. You know that scene in Devil Wears Prada where...
I know every season of Devil Wears Prada, the official movie of Hodinkee Radio.
The official movie of Stephen J. Pulvrich.
Yeah. There's that idea that every little detail, it's about the blue, that color blue.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, yeah,
cerulean blue.
That one. So... having not been to Basel, I always looked at it like this is where all these people get together and decide what's going to be popular. The decisions they make are going to affect what I buy, going back to the question earlier. But it's actually not that way. And what I found was that a lot of decisions are made in these meetings, kind of these impromptu meetings, based on feedback on conversations that they're having. It's not all planned. So
no, it's not. And there are... a lot of it happens on the fly.
Yeah, and watch brands are listening to not only industry people, but they're actually listening to consumers. So, you know, talking to these, getting a little inside baseball with them and them saying, yeah, we found that we see that people like this or they don't like that or whatever. And, you know, I know that they're listening to everything that you guys listening on this podcast are saying, and me too. And I would like to see more of that. I want to see consumers get a little bit more involved per se going forward.
Cool.
Interesting.
Mr. Forster, that's a tough act to follow.
You know, I was listening to Cole's comments, and when Joe and I were in Davos, we had a chance to talk to one of the founders of Movement, super nice guy named Jake, and also to one of the founders of Olivia Burton. And You know, one of the things that both of them said was that, you know, the success of both their brands was really owing to a very high degree of engagement with their clients on social media. So, like, Movement would not be, you know, a company valued at $80 million, and Olivia Burton, you know, I'm not sure what the, I can't remember offhand what the purchase price was, but, you know, these were both the flagship brands for the Movado Group, and they exist because of social media. They are successful because of social media. And, you know, just like direct engagement with consumers was critical to their success. And I feel like that's kind of the missing secret sauce for Baselworld. It was a B2B thing for so long, and I think there's still a B2B mentality. But if it's going to work for the Swiss watch industry and for the brands that participate, I think there has to be a direct, you know, sort of business-to-consumer component.
Nice. And Mr. Thompson?
Well, I'll pick up on Cole's point, too. The joy you felt this year at your first is the joy I feel this year at my 40th.
And oh, man, me too. That is amazing.
And that is what will be lost if Baselworld doesn't make it. There is a community here. There is the human factor. There are the people I only see here around the world that I know and I can't wait to see and I love to talk to. And so when I come back next year, and so the best thing that I hope, I have one more day, and of course I want to see a terrific presentation in the Blue Room that will convince not me but the people who count that there is a value to this. There is a value to 2 weeks of the year where the whole world gathers in Switzerland, in Basel and Geneva, if that's the way it has to be. And the whole world is watching and coming, and now this new consumer element. And so what do I want to see next year? I'm not going to play the politics of who should come back. I just want to see a bigger, better Basel world with this consumer element, and that the whole watch world just can't wait to come here every year the way I have for 40 years.
You know what makes me sad about Baselworld as it exists right now, Joe, and to your point and to Cole's point? This is, watchmaking in Switzerland is a unique cultural heritage of Switzerland. There are beautiful watches made in Germany. There are beautiful watches made in Japan, obviously. But, you know, this crazy thing that people love for some bizarre reason, from this tiny little country in the middle of Europe that has managed to stay out of a land war in Europe for 500 years, you know, it doesn't exist anywhere else. And I wish that, and I would like to put this out as a message to everyone who is a Swiss watch brand, you know, the Nicholas Hayek's of the world on down. I just want to say to you guys, you know, this exists nowhere else. And it's a valuable thing. It's a weird little beautiful thing. And, you know, maybe once a year at Basel, you know, we could all just come together with you guys and celebrate what this is.
Jack, on that, the roots of Baselworld, this show that we go to, is 102 years old. So it has survived the Great Depression, World War II.
Two wars.
Well, it was 1917. So you're right. You're right. Yeah. It started in a war.
Yeah,
survived all that. It survived the quartz watch crisis.
Two wars, the quartz watch crisis, LCD watches, LED watches, and several police actions.
I would hope that it could survive the digital revolution. We'll see.
Yeah. I guess my highlight, you know, touches, Joe, on something you said. You know, it's a particular word, which is community. And, you know, I think I love coming to Baselworld to see the new watches, but it's the people, really, you know, who make it for me. You know, it's the, you know, the folks you only see, like you said, once a year. It's the hugs, the handshakes, the smiles, the conversations that are, you know, sometimes about watches, sometimes not. Finding out how people's families are doing, like, really, like, it's a good reminder that these little fantastic, strange objects that we're all kind of obsessed with bring people together in weird ways. And there are so many awesome people who I would never have had a chance to meet or interact with if it wasn't for watches. I mean, that's kind of the whole premise behind doing this show is talking to those people, whether it's us internally or the folks we have on Hodinkee Radio, is that this world encompasses so many fascinating people, and getting to see those people is great. one of my favorite facets of that, and I won't go too crazy on this, is the media world here. You know, I'm a big, again, anybody who listens regularly will know this, like I'm a big media nerd as much as I'm into watches. And seeing how the watch media world has changed and evolved over the last, you know, this is my seventh Basel, has changed over the last 7 or 8 years is pretty wild, and how people are trying to cover the show and how there are so many people who are passionate about coming here and finding ways to tell stories about these things to the larger world, whether it's a niche world or the kind of general interest media. And that's exciting. I'm always interested to get here and see how people tell those stories. So I guess what I'm looking forward to next year is connected to that, which is, you know, I think a big part of whether the show succeeds or fails is about that messaging, and about how the stories of the watch industry get told to the world. And I think that for me is the thing I'm watching. Like, I want to know who's saying what about what's happening as much as I want to know about what's happening. So yeah, hopefully next year we'll have some good storytelling and some good news maybe to report. But yeah.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Wow, guys. So does this... That was so emotional.
I know Joe's got the blue room. I hope you don't come out a clone.
God, I hope he comes out at all.
Yeah.
Jeez. What is this?
They actually just have Nick Hayek in there just browbeating people. But yeah, I think that does it. Is that a wrap for us on Basel 2019?
Yes.
All right, guys.
I think so.
Let's call it. Show's over. This show's over. The Basel show is over for us. Let's go get those last stories up, get packed, crack a beer, get the hell back to New York.
Order some pizza.
Yeah. All right.
Bye.
Let's do it.
Later, bye, everybody.
Guys. Bye, everybody.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to our Basel World recap episodes. That's going to do it for us. And because you've gotten, I guess, what, 5 episodes of Hodinkee Radio this week, we're going to take a little bit of a break on Monday. So you won't get a new normal episode in your feed on Monday. But we'll be back the week after that, business as usual. And it's going to be a good one. You definitely want to stay tuned. All right. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you soon.